This is CliffCentral.com.
Justice, good morning and welcome to the show. And thank you for coming in today. Everybody gets very excited when you come in because we could talk about all the things that happened in the week.
I'm so excited. I'm actually very excited to see Ben here. I think he's been avoiding me. He thinks I come with bad news all the time.
Ben was in the Trans Sky, and he had only nice things to say about it.
Yeah, I went back to my roots in the Eastern Cape, and now I'm back.
These Eastern Cape guys, huh?
He said the Trans Sky is beautiful, but he was very disappointed. He sent us a picture of the Mandela Museum at Kruunu, and it was closed.
Oh, no.
Until 2019.
No, you're kidding me. I'll
show you the photo if you want.
Isn't that appalling?
Oh, that is just so shocking. You know, we went to the Steve Biko house and memorial in King Williamstown as mm-hmm. well. And basically, it was so disappointing. It just wasn't up to par at all, and there was just nothing put up. Basically, it was a disgrace, and it was, oh my word, this is a place that should be revered.
Well, I mean, Madiba died, 2013?
Yes.
So his burial site would be a major, major pilgrimage site in South Africa. Probably, it could be our biggest tourist destination.
It still
hasn't been opened up. Still, nobody can go and visit his grave. Oh. This is probably the greatest South African ever, and people can't go and visit his grave, which in South Africa is a big thing.
Oh my word.
Like right by the main road there, the highway, there's a massive house that's kind of chained up. I'm guessing that's his house.
Yeah, that's his house next to the road.
On the right there. Yeah.
Ben's just showing me a picture here, and the sign is up. The Nelson Mandela Museum, Kruunu site, is closed for renovations until April 2019. We apologize for the inconvenience caused.
It took less time to build all the World Cup stadiums for the 2010 World Cup. Like, what are they renovating?
Oh.
Are they waiting for tenders to kick in? Like, what's going on?
It's very disappointing. But besides that, he said it's a beautiful part of the country. Obviously, the Eastern Cape is under huge economic strain. There are people leaving left, right, and center because there's just not enough work there. And there isn't enough of an economy in the Eastern Cape to speak of. So no, I feel bad for those people. I really do.
And it is beautiful. It's beautiful. As a part of South Africa that has done so much for this country, you think about so many of our great leaders mm-hmm. who come from those parts. But I was reading...
We had Linda Vilakazi from the OR and Adelaide Tambo Foundation on Tuesday, and we were talking about the Tambos and their contribution to South Africa. And we spoke a little bit about the Sisulus, obviously, and the Mandelas, and lots of other people who have had such an impact on South Africa. And, you know, we forget so easily.
Now, you think about it, I've been reading a lot about Chris Hani, and Chris Hani came from the Eastern Cape.
Uh-huh.
But when he got to Fort Hare, for example, Fort Hare University, it's just incredible for me, the names that run through that life, that run through that province, and what the schools then in the 50s and 60s did for South Africa. All this, the cream of the crop came from the Eastern Cape. And for me, one of the saddest things, so people say a lot about, rugby and transformation in rugby or in other sports. You know, one of the things for me is, man, you just have to go to the Eastern Cape. Those are weird black people. They play rugby. They love rugby. They know the rules. They know what a scrum is.
Yep.
What is that?
Yep, they're a bit too weird for my liking.
And so that all these schools that produce these amazing people academically, you know, I always laugh and feel sad at the same time. When I fly into the Eastern Cape, into PE or East London, there'll be three or four people who have PhDs on my flight. And it will be people I know, doctor this, doctor that, doctor this, doctor. All this incredible. And they're all lost to the Eastern Cape. They've left.
Yeah.
And you sit there and you say, what is development? What does it mean when you have to leave your home, when you have to leave your... The area where you grew up to go and look for a job and find a job, and then you're never going there. I mean, there'll always be urbanization, but I think there is something fundamentally wrong that's happened in the Eastern Cape. Mm. And, you know, the stories of unemployment, of underdevelopment, and on and so forth and so forth. It's a massive, huge sadness about that province.
Well, let's talk about potentially the reasons for a lot of economic stagnation in South Africa.
Can we just stay on the good news for a bit?
I would like to. Okay. Do you want to try that? What can we do? What can we do that's good news?
Well, I just want to say, you know, I felt so bad the past few weeks when I didn't see Ben. And I started thinking, man, Justice, you got to find some good news around here, you know? And so on the schedule there, I think the first deal you've got is Eskom. And I was thinking, my word, someone got paid R500 million without a contract. There was no contract between the Gupta-linked, Salim Essa-linked Trillion Capital and Eskom. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I come through, man. I'll give you R500 million in consultancy fees. Consulting is a lovely business because what did you do for me exactly? But, you know.
I was saying the same thing earlier. And also, if you need so many consultants, are you really in charge? Are you really a CEO?
Exactly. Basically, it's saying, I can't do the job, but I've got lots of cash and I'm going to pay someone to do the work.
Correct.
And I'm just going to pitch up and be in the group picture. That's what you're saying. Oh, it's very sad.
I'll pitch up for the group picture.
No, that's what happens here. That's why you're paying someone $500 million to basically do your job.
I mean, $500 million.
$500 million. Guys, I'm sorry. I'm leaving now. I'm going to be a consultant.
Yeah, I was just going to say, is this going to cause like a spike in an interest in people thinking, maybe I should just become a consultant?
Yeah.
And also, it's so nebulous. Like, what exactly does a consultant do? Because if the company does very poorly, the consultant doesn't get fined or blamed or locked in jail or held responsible by the board.
They just get paid.
Right. And if it goes really well, the consultant doesn't necessarily make any slice of that either, unless they're doing something on commission.
No.
So what is the actual work?
Well, you know, that would be great if you had a contract, we'd know that these guys did, you know, they facilitated a deal, they did this and so forth. We don't even know. There's no contract. It's just, hey, Ben, you look so handsome. Boom. $500 million. There you go, boy.
Jeez, what a
you
pleasure. Off.
You know, I mean, what am I doing?
All right, let's talk about the big picture here, though, because these Gupta leaks and all the last communiques from Eskom, which have suddenly been revealed.
Yeah.
We spoke to Polly van Wyk the other day from Scorpio.
Yeah.
And she was telling us about how Brian Molefe's pension and everything works.
Yes.
There seem to be a lot of little bits and pieces of information trickling out now about how corrupt the private sector has been. Because we tend to think of government corruption. And we've discussed this many times, Justice. You've often said the corruptor and the corruptee are both equally guilty. And we often hear about the person in government who's taking the cash or who's providing the tenders, but we don't often hear about who's the recipient or, in the case of the private sector, who is making these dodgy deals.
Absolutely.
Now, thanks to all of these leaks, it's all starting to come out in the wash, and we're seeing quite reputable up to now companies who are suddenly finding themselves covered in mud and feces. KPMG, McKinsey, SAP, Liebherr,
it's all in there.
These people must all have, they must pay a price reputationally, if not financially.
Yeah, but not only that. I mean, I've been amazed by, take SAP, for example.
Right.
When the story came out, SAP issued a very belligerent, how dare you, this is wrong, you can't do this, and this is, you're lying about us, and so forth. The SAP in Germany immediately said, 1, 2, 3, 4, the top four people, you are suspended. We are sending an investigative team down. We are going to come down hard on you. How dare you?
Accountability.
Accountability.
What a nice thing to see.
McKinsey? Now, McKinsey's role has been a bit worrisome on the Eskom thing. But at least one person has been suspended, and there's a full-on investigation from their New York office.
I mean, for God's sake, even Bell Pottinger suspended the partner who was involved. Even if Bell Pottinger can, how come we have to keep people on full pay and keep them in their position.
Exactly. So look at Eskom yesterday. There's a man called Anoj Singh. He's the chief financial officer.
Right.
Anoj Singh is at the very heart of every corrupt, dodgy Gupta-linked deal that's come out. So he was, when Brian Molefe went to Transnet, guess who he needed by his side to be his finance chief? Anoj Singh. When he moved to Eskom, guess who he needed by his side to be his finance chief? Anoj Singh. Anoj Singh is at the heart and center of every story that's going on here. He's the guy who paid that 500 million, okay? What's he doing? Yesterday he stood, or sat in front of the media and the country and said, hey, you know, this is what it is. Has he been suspended? No. Has he been in any way? Is there any action? No. In fact, he tells us that, no, I will tell you, I'm going to release a some kind of tell-all document and you'll get to know all about it. We shouldn't even be waiting for the guy. He should be, the law should be coming down hard on this guy. So,
but surely, you know, if you do this in private business, there are certain things that start to happen. You get declared a delinquent director, for example, when you're found to have been acting fraudulently and so on. Why are these ordinary processes not triggered?
I think a few are. You know, the reason why I was so worried about Ben's health and his mental well-being is that I wanted to assure him that I'm beginning to see a silver lining to all this stuff. So to your initial question, so you're seeing the private sector implicated in all this, and it's a truth that we sometimes ignore. Mm-hmm. When someone pays a bribe to someone in the public sector, a DG, a head of a tender board, and so forth, it's someone in the private sector. So we talk about corruption as if it's just Malala receiving and it's not Ben giving the bribe. But it takes two to tango here, and that's where the corruption is. So we're beginning to see the private sector come out exposed, and that is a good thing. That is a powerful, powerful thing. Because you know what? In reputation is everything. Mm-hmm. Right now, who is a McKinsey or a Trillion client who's sitting there saying, do I want to be associated with these people? Do I want my name to be on some news site saying, this is what happened, this is what these guys are doing? No, they don't.
Right.
That's the beginning of accountability, and that's the beginning of people being exposed.
Because there is a cost to association with bad people.
Exactly. Exactly. There is a cost, and that cost can be, it can bring down businesses. It can bring down your entire enterprise. So for me, Ben, that's the silver lining. That now it's no longer, I'm no longer waiting for, I'm no longer just waiting for Sean the Sheep to lay charges or to prosecute Saudi Motsoeneng.
Mm-hmm.
People in the private sector are sitting there saying, this guy, I don't want to be next to him. And
right.
So all his associates are falling by the wayside.
Uh-huh.
Increasingly, you'll see action by the private sector that says, I'm washing my hands of this. And that has to cascade through to the public sector. You're beginning to see bits of action. Think about yesterday. James Aguma, who was the acting CEO at SABC.
Sorry, SABC,
Now, James Aguma was basically Saudi Motsoeneng's go-to guy.
Henchman.
I like that word. See, can you be my henchman? So he's henchman. Go and kill Mabale.
There we go. As a henchman.
As a henchman.
Listen, when you're talking about Makosi Kosa, it doesn't sound so funny anymore.
No, it doesn't sound funny at all. And we must talk about that, actually.
Yeah.
But one of the things about Aguma was that yesterday he arrives, he sits there, it's a disciplinary hearing, it's, guy, you are you're going down. And he realizes that he's going down. And so, oops, sorry, I'm resigning. Huh. And he resigned. What's going to happen now? There is a criminal investigation about monies paid and monies moved and so forth. And it's going to come through. And he might go to jail. When he realizes he might go to jail, he might want to do a deal. And that deal might be saying, oh, you know, I actually, as a henchman, I took orders from Justice Malala. Oh, Saudi Mutsoneng. There you go. And so, should I do a deal and turn state witness? I mean, these cases are going to start happening. And many, many people are going to realize that when it starts, when the first domino falls, then the second one goes, and there's going to be a whole bunch of people looking to get themselves fitted out with some orange suits. And I think that's a fantastic thing. That's a really, it's powerful, it's good. So
in other words, we can look forward to a lot more news of people being held to the fire for the things they've done.
Look, we might not get jobs in consulting, but we'll be very busy in journalism, that's for sure. Mabale is just not going to rest, because there's a lot more coming. There's a lot more coming out of the Gupta leaks, but there's action that's going to start happening around all this criminality, and we'll be going to court to watch it.
So let's talk about Eskom for a second, because this Brian Molefe and pension situation, it's very interesting. Seems but you can get away with quite a lot if you just know the right people, because you don't have to go through due process. They can make your age 63 even though you're 50. It's incredible what
basically can be achieved. I mean, the Skopje story, and you said listeners have heard from Polly van Wyk. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing, incredible story. But it shows you just how criminality works and how it worked at Eskom. You have a superstar CEO. He is alleged to be the man who knows everything, and basically,
I mean, he would have been if the president had his way, our finance minister. That's what we're told.
Absolutely. And what was done for Brian Molefe, with Brian Molefe, was to essentially subvert the system to make one man rich, and that man is Brian Molefe. All those rules that were bent, all those rules that were ignored just so that he could make 30 million rand on his pension. But what is coming through from Eskom is that essentially at every level it was a looting spree.
Doesn't this tell us something about the character of the man who would have been our finance minister? And doesn't it show us just how incredibly shallow the process must be for the president to appoint these people?
Well, it shows us how corrupt it is. Yeah. I'm sorry to say this, but...
I mean, to lie about your age by a whole 13 years, just so you can get paid out a bigger pension, to work there for 15 months, and yet the record reflects that you were there for 150 months... They're able to just manipulate figures left, right, and center. Can you imagine the kind of looting that would have taken place in the treasury?
The kind of looting that has taken place at Eskom under his watch is stupendous. So it tells you something about the man, but it tells you something about the people who wanted him in those strategic positions. I think we don't know what really happened at Transnet. I think major looting happened at Transnet, and it will be revealed, some of it will be revealed, under Brian Molefe, because what happened at Eskom tells us just a bit about who he was. So, the decision to give him 30 million rand and then move him to National Treasury to become our finance minister shows you the cynicism and the plans that were in place for him to go and basically open things up now for major, absolute. Under Brian Molefe, with Brian Molefe as finance minister, we would have been a banana republic. He was essentially moving to National Treasury to do what has happened, what we now know happened at Eskom, and what we now know happened at at Transnet.
And this is the guy who was crying on TV and saying just how sad he was, and he's been forced out, but he knows he's done the right thing, and he did the best he could for the people of South Africa. He did the best he could for him.
Mm.
There is no one more selfish in Eskom than Brian Molefe.
But connect the dots. Trillion Capital is the company that made millions at Transnet under his watch. It's the same company that made 500 million and other monies at Eskom when mm-hmm. he was there. Trillion is the same company that prepared documents for Des van Rooyen
mm-hmm.
when he moved to the finance ministry. At the heart of it was this company that goes to the Guptas, that goes to the president of South Africa, and essentially it was, we've made some short change at Transnet and Eskom, let's go for the big one.
Mm-hmm.
You'll remember the email that was received from one of Des van Rooyen's advisors, appointed by Trillion, by the way, one of them a former worker at Trillion, a consultant, which began with the words, "Gents, finally we are in." That was an email actually sent by one of his...
you have to be so brazen.
Yeah.
"Gents, finally. Finally, Ben.
We got our hands in the till.
We've been waiting, baby.
The till is the trough is open.
But we are in now. This is the same company." So you can see it was, okay, let's do a practice run at Transnet. Okay, let's really see what we can do at Eskom. And now let's just go for it. Mabale is going to get better. You don't have to leave.
Mabale's walked out in protest because she's obviously a shareholder in Trillion.
She's going to be a consultant.
All right, Justice, let's talk about this Conference for the Future of South Africa. What is this?
The Conference for the Future of South Africa happened on Tuesday, I believe. It was held here in Johannesburg. For me, there were many, many parallels to what happened in the 1980s. I know that Ben and the guys are very young, so they don't remember the UDF. You sit there and say the UDF, what's he talking about, that old geezer? The United Democratic Front was an alliance of the South African Council of Churches, of NGOs, of community organizations, civic organizations in the 1980s, and it was essentially a bit of the ANC inside the country. It stood up against apartheid. It launched campaigns like the Defiance Campaign, for example, when in Pretoria, for example, people would go onto the so-called whites-only buses and get on. In Cape Town, black people would go and sit on the whites-only beaches and basically render apartheid laws unenforceable.
Stupid and futile. Yeah.
Exactly. Now, this is where people like Popo Molefe, people like Mephi Morobe, people like Vali Musa,
Trevor Manuel,
yeah. All these, Cheryl Carolus, that's where they came through and became massive, big leaders of the Mass Democratic Movement, as it was called, and the UDF in the 1980s. In 1989, as the apartheid regime was crumbling, a conference was held called the Conference for a Democratic Future.
Mm-hmm.
And it was held at Wits University, and I remember it well because I couldn't go. I had to work, and it was terrible. And I was a young kid, and all I wanted to do was go and see these amazing people and, you know, drink in some of this amazing stuff. But that was the end of apartheid. Essentially, South Africa had come together and said, this far and no further. I was amazed by the people in the room on Tuesday because so many of those people were the same people who said in 1989, that's it, you are done. And they were in that room on Tuesday. I think something is shifting in South Africa. There was a time when we'd sit on this show and say, oh, we've just spoken about the corruption at Eskom, and oh, it's debilitating and it's depressing, and Ben would start crying, and Mabale would walk out, and it would be, there's no silver lining, it's so dark, I can't see the end of the tunnel. But I think things are shifting quite rapidly. What you saw with this conference was that you had the SA Council of Churches, you had business leaders under Business Leadership South Africa, you had NGOs, you had youth organizations, you had people not just from disgruntled ANC people, but you had people from the Fallist movement, people basically saying, not in my name, you can't be paying 1,500,000,000 rand and think it's okay. You had brave ANC MPs like Makosi Khoza, like Pravin Gordhan, Mcebisi Jonas, people who've stood up against the rot that you're seeing in politics. So it's small beginnings, but I think there's a real shift. If you take what happened at that conference and then you add on a bit of what NGOs, what the media, what other parts of South African society are doing to expose some of the stuff that's going on, I think we're on the cusp. I think within the ANC there's a revolt against the depth, the corruption that has gone on in the ANC's name. I think that even a guy like Jackson Tembu, who says Makosi Khoza must be disciplined, doesn't disagree with her. He only thinks, no, don't go outside and talk about it with Sia and Mabale and Justice. Let's talk about it inside at home and so forth and so forth. But fundamentally, he would be a guy who'd be in that room as well. So I think there's a shift. I think that it's a complicated time to be in politics in South Africa because people are trying to find their way. But I think the pressure is going to increase on Jacob Zuma and his and the corrupt elements around him. I think that the law enforcement agencies at some point are going to realize that things have shifted. And we cannot continue as the Hawks, as the SIU, to protect Jacob Zuma. And something needs to happen. And I think when that starts happening, there's a whole load of things that are going to happen all at the same time. And well, I think
well, speaking,
the next
speaking of those law enforcement units, can we just quickly mention the NPA and Duduzane Zuma?
The NPA has behaved abominably. Excuse me.
This is Shaun the Sheep and Company.
The National Prosecuting Authority is supposed to take cases from the police which have been investigated and bring charges against all of us if we've done something wrong. Duduzane Zuma was driving his Porsche. It was a rainy night. There are all kinds of things that are said about the case, but essentially he was in an accident with a taxi. Two people died. One of them died directly as a result of the accident. The other one went to hospital and died 2 weeks later. Now, the allegation by the state is
these are people who've lost their lives and who, you know, there's got to be someone held responsible for this.
Absolutely. So there was a hearing, an inquiry with a judge, and the judge found that it was due to Duduzane Zuma's negligence that this accident happened. It is worth noting that when the accident happened, Mr. Zuma didn't go to a police station and give a statement. He only went 8 days later. The first person he called was Rajesh Tony Gupta. It's worth noting that just days before he went to court, he got his lawyers to make sure that his previous high speed traffic fines were settled very quietly so that they were not mentioned at the inquiry.
Hmm.
There's enough here for the police and the NPA to essentially say, let's look into this further. It was a high profile case, but the NPA got the docket, got the inquiry's judgment from the magistrate, the judge, and decided to not go ahead with the prosecution, and very quietly didn't tell anyone that, no, we're not going ahead. It just basically put the file, the docket, in Cabinet Z, and that was the end of that. So who does the law work for? If today Sia has an accident on Rivonia Road, there will be processes. He will go to a police station, make a statement, and so forth, and so forth. And there'll be a culpable homicide charge against him. That's how the law works. But it seems in this case, the law didn't seem to work that way. In this case,
how does it not work? I mean, I was arrested for speeding once, for speeding. There weren't people killed.
Yeah,
I was going too fast on a highway.
Mm.
I had to admit guilt because I take responsibility for myself. This is not me virtue signaling, by the way. This is just how the law works.
Yeah.
I still had to go to court. I got fined. It was substantial. And I had to pay that fine before they would let me out of the court.
Exactly.
Now, there was a responsibility there. The law came in. I mean, this judge said to me, you are a bad, because he was going to make an example of me.
Mm.
A week later, a different set of circumstances for Steve Hoffmeyer. Another week later, Julius Malema. the two of them did not accept guilt. They argued that they were not guilty.
Mm.
They had lawyers there. Their lawyers said to them, don't worry about this. There's no problem. They didn't have to pay a fine. They argued that the equipment was faulty. They argued that this wasn't right, that wasn't right. There wasn't necessarily accountability. They didn't have to go through the legal processes. But at least there was a process.
Yeah, yeah. In this case...
Kutu Zanizuma, how come he doesn't have to fulfill any...
Well, that's a good question. And the question now is... Is it because he is the son of the president, or he's just lucky, or he's innocent? We will never know. The problem with not having a full-on process is that today we sit here, and I can speculate, you can speculate, we can all speculate that, no, the law works differently for Sia, and it works differently for you and for me and for him. Because he is who he is, it works differently. And this goes to the heart of trust between the public and the state. If people begin to say, ah, well, it's Dudu Zani, he'll never go down, he'll never face the law, he'll, you know, money, connections, work, then what is to stop me going to buy a driver's license in
what this tells us more than that the law is starting to become effete and not necessarily applicable. That worries everybody, because in a constitutional democracy, that's one part of it. The other part of it is the law must apply equally to all people.
Absolutely.
There are no super people. There are no whites only and black only and apartheid era laws for different kinds of people. It is the same law for everyone.
We are
surely.
All equal before the law. So Gareth, the important thing for me here is that the media has exposed that. The Gupta leaks have exposed some of this stuff. Emails between all these players have been obtained by the Times and the Sunday Times. And the key for me is there was a time when I would be despondent that nothing is going to happen. But let me tell you now, something's going to happen.
Tell me.
Because one prosecution is going to start, and then people will be sitting in an office in Tshwane thinking, if I don't prosecute that case, what's going to happen with me now? So suddenly you're going to have a cascade of these cases. I'm telling you, the scenario that I'm seeing now is that there's going to be one, and then you're going to see all of them begin. Because it's not as if in all these cases the evidence is not there. The evidence is there. The paperwork, the paper trail is all there. It's all there. If you look at the revelations around this particular accident, the emails, you, me, we can access those emails. All you have to do is go on the Amabungani site. They'll tell you where they are, and you can just go and look at them.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely, it's all there. It's just that you take the time to go through it. So one case is going to start blowing this stuff up, and one guy is going to start singing, and suddenly you're going to see. And that is when several things are going to happen. Power is going to shift. It's going to become clear that the Jacob Zuma administration has come to its last legs, and someone else is going to come in. And people, when people start realizing that, it's changing, they start saying, what am I doing with Ben? I'm going to go with Sia now. And I'm telling you, that's when you're going to see a whole bunch of prosecutions. I'm no longer despondent about it. It's coming. It's slow and so forth, but it's coming.
That's fantastic news. So you say it's like a house of cards.
It's a house of cards, and it's gonna crumble.
All right. Finally, Batabile Dlamini. She was. I watched this fantastic clip. I don't know if you saw it in the news.
Mm-hmm.
You're on ENCA with the Justice Factor. It was on ENCA. Let's give Karen Morn credit.
Yeah.
She's been stalking Batabile Dlamini at every turn. And we joke and we laugh about Karen Morn and journalists who are after these different ministers. But in this case, she's tenacious. She was following the minister. She put that microphone and that camera in her face, said, listen, it's time you account. What's going on with Sasa? What's going on with Magwaza? What's happening with these payments? There are millions of South Africans who are dependent on your department. What do you have to say about the situation? Batabile Dlamini, like a rock star in a pair of sunglasses and a cap. I mean, Sia, you saw the picture.
Yes. Okay. Can we talk about the sunglasses?
Let's talk about this whole scenario, because there is no more incompetent a minister than this current Batabile Dlamini.
Her spokesperson was literally swatting microphones away.
Lumka. Is she still the spokesperson, Lumka Welifant?
She's tough.
Who refused to speak English during an English interview she'd agreed to be a part of.
Yeah, no, she doesn't mess around. Like, she's got no time for anyone.
Her SWAT game, her arm was just on another level.
Let us remember fundamentally that these people who are behaving like rock stars in front of the camera and swatting microphones away, these people are our servants. They are the servants of the people of South Africa. No more so than in the Department of Social Welfare, where your entire responsibility is to the poorest of the poor, where your entire purpose for being, your entire department and portfolio, is about providing some scant means for the most underprivileged of South Africans.
Mm, absolutely.
And you behave like a rock star.
I have to say, I mean, what are we going to do about Batabile Dlamini? I mean, there is nothing that says incompetence as much as that ministry. The Sasa debacle was so horrific. It was basically, you did not do your job, and the Constitutional Court now has to do your job for you, has to tell you how to do the job for you. And you have to remember, this is the only minister who has to go to Mohoeng every 3 months. You know, when you're in jail, okay, and you get parole, you have to go to your parole officer with your, you get tagged, okay? And you have to go to your parole officer and say, I'm behaving every week or every day sometimes. So you have to go to the local police station. This is a minister, right, who has to go to the Constitutional Court like a common law prisoner and say, I'm behaving, I'm doing it right, I'm working on it. Every 3 months. It's extraordinary that she hasn't been fired. But why am I expecting that? Anyway, so she says, when she's asked to do her job, and that is to account to the people of South Africa, that 17 million people on social grants and the agency that pays these social grants every month, the CEO who says, I'm under threat, I'm receiving death threats, people saying they're going to kill me, and so forth. The CEO leaves, and she says, you are harassing me, instead of explaining what's going on here. Now, I want to, you spoke about Makosi Khoza earlier, Gerard. One of the things about Makosi Khoza is that for months and months, she's been saying she's been receiving death threats. Kulegani Magwaza at SASA has been saying, I'm receiving death threats.
Mm-hmm.
The former DG in Bathabile Dlamini's department, Zain Dango, had people arrive at his house and manhandle his kids, break into the house. He is still living in danger today. People are scared in this country. They're scared that they're going to be shot at, killed. They're receiving death threats. And nothing happens. This minister used 1 million rand of the Department of Social Development's money to get herself extra security because she said her life is in danger. Her spokesperson also got security without going to the police, going through, they took ministry money, Department of Social Development, and said, yeah, we will pay. I think it was 1.4 million. There's a number. It's more than a million rand. So, it's the mind boggles, actually, that this person still believes that they have some credibility, some standing in cabinet or in South African public life. But that said, the departure of Magwaza from SASA is hugely worrying. This minister has been told to fix the mess that she caused at social development. Remember that you spoke about if you are calling in consultants to do the job, it means you are not doing the job. What she did was to set up her friends and her consultants in something called work streams, whereas there are people whose job it is to do this. But she didn't like them. She didn't want them. She wanted them to reach a certain result. And so she established them. The Constitutional Court said, do away with this. Fire these people that you set up in these so-called work streams. And that's what Magwaza was doing. And that's why he's been fired. And we mustn't allow it to happen. We can't have a situation where basically all of us are going to just sit here and let her get away with it. It shouldn't. So she must continue to be exposed. I think that Karen Mon is amazing and incredible and has done a fantastic job of holding her to account. And she must continue to ask her, and we must all continue to ask those questions. You know, can I just say, journalists have been amazing in this period. Yesterday, it was Sikonathi Mantsantsa from Business Day Financial Mail holding Anoj Singh and pushing them to say, what did you do with that 500 million until they admitted it? In all these press conferences, it's been Karen Mon who said, answer the questions, Minister. And you know, all power to these journalists, really.
You remember her at that press conference. We played it yesterday.
Yeah.
Where she was asking Bathabile Dlamini about the relationship between her and Magwaza.
Exactly.
And she was just absolutely noncommittal on every front. You could not get a straight answer out of her.
Yeah.
If her, the whole purpose for being can be distilled into one or two sentences, one of those sentences needs to be accountability to the public of South Africa, particularly those on welfare.
And she's totally unaccountable. She
doesn't care.
She doesn't care. And this is the problem when you know, there's an interesting commission of inquiry going on in KwaZulu-Natal, and it's about all the killings that have happened in KwaZulu-Natal. And one of the things that a professor of politics and sociology at UKZN, who testified there, said was that we need to change the system. The reason why you have so many killings happening, so Sia is the local councillor, and I start thinking, ooh, I want the job. And I get some people to bump him off so that I can be the counselor. And he said one of the reasons is that people, there is no qualification to be a counselor. You can be Justice Malala, no education, straight from the streets, but if I can shout louder than Gareth, then I get the one that gets elected and I get the job. And he said, maybe what we need to do now is start saying, to be a counselor, you need to have a junior degree. And maybe then we will start to say, well, should I kill him? I'm not going to get the job anyway because I don't have a junior degree. And I found that interesting because, really, the only reason Batabile Dlamini is the Minister of Social Development is because she is the president of the ANC Youth League, Women's League. And so she's just there to, where can we put her? There isn't a single portfolio that she can actually perform in that cabinet. We have 34, we have 34 cabinet members. And I'm telling you, take her to any one of them, she will be just as bad. She shouldn't be in cabinet. She shouldn't be. And basically, we are prisoners of politics because, well, we've got to put someone from
But doesn't this show us how there's such a dearth of leadership even within the Women's League that this woman has risen to the top? How pointless must their meetings be? How unuseful must their various statements and positions actually be in the scheme of things when this is the woman who is the crowning achievement, who is the leader and the one who sets the tone for the Women's League? What has this organization that was once proud, that stood for something, become? We've got to ask these questions, surely.
You know, there's a big feminist movement going on across the globe. The feminist movements of the 60s and so forth, have really come back and are claiming their space and are fighting back against patriarchy and so forth and so forth. One of the things that I found incredible was when Batabile Dlamini, as president of the ANC Women's League, was defending the fact that there are so many women, so many amazing women researchers on every facet of the economy, of finance, of anthropology, of sociology, of everything, okay? Mm-hmm. And the ANC Women's League chose 6 men to go and be part of its delegation at the ANC National Policy Conference. What do you say about women in the ANC when you go and pack your delegation with men? And you know what she said when people asked her, why do you have men in the ANC Women's League delegation? She said it's because women get emotional. I mean, she should be fired by her organization, let alone the president and the in cabinet. She shouldn't be. I'm sorry to be emotional, but she shouldn't be anywhere near a feminist movement. It's
embarrassing.
It's embarrassing. It's not. She is a disgrace to any kind of.
I mean, a man in the 1600s would have held his tongue on that fact.
I can't believe it. Well, that's the end of the betting platform. I mean, quite frankly, I can't talk about. I've got to leave now. You know,
all right, Justice.
You've outdone yourself.
I'm walking out. I can't.
Thank you, Justice Malala. The burning platform is brought to you every week by Nando's.
Malala.
Today was very hot. Today, on that scale of lemon and herb, hot,
mild,
very hot. This one was burning
off the charts.
The platform has burnt through. No, I could do it to Nando's now.
This is CliffCentral.com.